This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Some years back, Irene Gut Opdyke heard neo-Nazi groups call the Holocaust a hoax. That led her to travel across the U.S. to tell her story and, with the help of Jennifer Armstrong, write it down. Opdyke comes from a Polish Catholic family. During the war, she became active in the resistance, aiding and rescuing Jews. Her involvement began when Hitler invaded Poland. It was 1939. She was 17 years old. As time passed, she grew bolder. In a very dangerous move, she hid 12 Jews in the home of a German officer for whom she worked. Israel, the Israeli Holocaust Commission, and the Vatican have honored Irene Opdyke for her actions during the war. She tells her story in a book co-authored with Jennifer Armstrong. It is titled In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer. Jennifer Armstrong is an award-winning author of historical fiction. Her books include Black-Eyed Susan and Shipwreck at the Bottom of the World. Both women are our guests this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. And listeners, I invite your questions and comments for them. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer is now available in a paperback edition from Anchor Books. Irene, Jennifer, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello. Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you.
How did the two of you come together to write this book, Irene?
I think that Jennifer did read my first book that I wrote it with my daughter. And she really liked it so much that she liked to write my story.
Mm. And Jennifer, how was that first book that Irene wrote different? How is it different from the one the two of you wrote together?
Well, part of the difference had to do with the intended audience. I knew that because Irene was a teenager when this whole thing started, that her story would be of interest to a lot of younger readers. And so I wanted to make sure that in the book that I wrote with Irene, that it covered more of her early years, so that we could see where does somebody like Irene start? Where, you know, how do you become a person who could do these incredible things? And so that was one of the differences, and of course another difference is that as much as Irene has become accustomed to talking about her experiences, I think she probably needed some professional help with writing. So that's where I came in.
That's true.
Yeah.
I didn't go to school here in America.
Yeah, so a somewhat more skillful writerly technique was, I think, called for to do justice to the story.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And I am so very, very glad because she really becomes me. She did find my heart, my soul. And I am very comfortable because that were exactly my feelings.
Yeah. The book is filled with moments of great courage and also of great horror and terror. Jennifer, how did writing this book affect you? And you put yourself into Irene's voice comes through you in this book.
Right. Well, it was, I mean, obviously extremely difficult and very painful to do justice to a story like this. You have to, you know, imagine yourself completely in this, in these scenarios, and it was horrifying and frightening, and so there were many times while I was working on the manuscript that I would have to, you know, walk away from it and just take a few minutes to kind of compose myself, and of course the inevitable thing that happens when you're doing something like this is that I, as the writer, began to compare my own values and abilities with what I was describing Irene doing, and that kind of soul searching can be upsetting too.
Yeah, Irene, I'm sure that Jennifer asked you many, many questions to draw out your memories. What was it like to sit down with her and recall so many things from that time?
Well, I remember it was quite pleasant. I invite her to stay in my home, you know, and then we were always together, we eating, and she was not really always like interviewing me in a talking. Many things she asked for my youth, for my, and I am so glad that she picked up the things that I never did mention in the book that I wrote it before with my daughter, you know, because she picked up my title. The first was I Am in a Promised Land, Israel, but she wrote it that was moved me very much, and I was really sure that she did become, in a way, me when she described my father meeting my mother.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like we're right there.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just wonderful, and when she sent me the first draft, and I said, Jennifer, you find my heart. You did find my soul.
Tell us, Irene, how your parents met.
Well, my parents, that was always when a young girl's in the marriage age, like 17, 18, they met by the river. They met a little boat, piece of wood with the flowers and candle. And it was already getting sort of dark. They led the little boat into the lake, you know, and about miles or two farther away, there were men catching the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And my father did catch my mother's boat.
And then when they met?
And then met, they got married.
Yeah.
You know, all the boats doing, they have a name of the girls, you know.
Yeah, the way that Irene described this custom to me was, it was so beautiful and so so sweet. And I thought that part of what I wanted to do in describing Irene's experience was not just to talk about what happened to Irene, but to talk about what happened to Poland.
That's correct.
And so here is an example of an absolutely exquisite folk custom. And I just had to start with that and show.
That was beautiful. I was so happy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We did not talk about, but we talk. She was with me, and we talk about. I talk about my family, my school, this and that, and she just picked up the thing that really speak to me too.
Right. Even when the tape recorder wasn't on, I was taking
correct.
Notes mentally.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. The tape, it was not always there, but we talk. We talk constantly, and she's an unbelievable writer, and I am very, very happy that she came into my life.
Something that happens for the reader very early in the book is that we come to understand that your parents formed you and your sisters into caring people. Your
That's
parents,
correct.
Your parents were people who were committed to helping others.
That's correct. My mother took in gypsies, and you know, and they did have no good name, and they were saying this and that about. But when they were sick, and we always made it packages, and we always brought it to people that needed. And by Christmas or holidays, we did have always invited one or two or three people that are poor and lonely to spend it with us.
And there were always animals you were taking care
That's
of.
That's correct. We have dogs and cats and birds, even stork.
The stork with the broken wing.
Yes. And because, and we always, my mother, from the early spring to autumn, we brought it all the greenery and flowers from the field. And my mother never said, what will I do with that? Or then when we brought it sick, dog or cat, or she never said, well, I don't know how she knew what to do. Mm. And she was a wonderful, wonderful person. And she said, now you are not born for yourself. You're born to share your life and help when the help is needed. That was my mother's motto.
Yeah. You mentioned your parents taking care of gypsies when they were in,
that's true.
In need of care, in need of help.
That's, she did have she was very sick, that gypsy. And she would die. And, you know, it was not easy because the gypsy did not particularly want it to go to the homes. But that was a beautiful young woman, gypsy. And my mother was so feeling sorry for her, she could hardly breathe. So she called the doctor, and we did have a nice big couch. So there was a room for her to for a week or two till she got feeling better.
Yeah, and this is unusual for the middle class in Poland to shelter gypsies who were social outcasts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is correct. But my parents were different. I never heard anti-Semitism or this is a Jew, this is this and this is that, you know. We were the same.
Was your family, were your parents political?
Not my... My daddy was architect, and he worked for the lights on a telegraphic pole. You know that white thing.
The glass insulators.
Yeah, that's what he worked, and he was a very, very much Polish. And my father, as a young man, before he married my mother. He was with Piłsudski, with the president, you know, when the war of the, he was before married, you know, he was in the army. That was in 1918, you know, that the towards the end of the war.
The First World War.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as a girl, were you aware of anti-Semitism, were you aware of Hitler and what was brewing?
Well, not in the beginning at all, because I did have many Jewish friends. We did go for walks together. We were close, you know. But like in 1937, I heard here and there that because we live about 6 kilometers from German border. So we heard that Hitler is doing to their own people, you know, that were not like 1937 when the child was not normal born or they were killing their own children because they wanted a perfect race. And then 1938, the Kristallnacht, you know. And that, in a way, I didn't have a brother. So I told my daddy that I wanted to be a nurse because when it come to war, you don't have a son. I feel I am the oldest one. I will go fight for my country. Mm. And that's the reason they signed me to the nursing school, and that's how everything began.
Yeah, you were a student nurse, and
yes,
when Hitler invaded, you volunteered to go with the Polish army.
That's correct. I go with the Polish army, and we were really retreating because Hitler was bombarding, follow with the aeroplanes and throwing the bomb, and we were retreating. Finally, we came to the Russian, close to Russian border, and then the Polish army said we put a stop. But instead that, we did find out that Hitler and Stalin made a pact and took my country from both sides. Poland was no more.
When that,
and I was lost little girl.
Yeah. When that Polish general told the soldiers, and you were there with them, Poland was no more.
Yeah.
Do you remember what
many of the Polish officers start taking the insignia. Few were committing suicide. They could not take it. And then we did have to open the warren houses, and we escaped to the Ukrainian forest. I could not go home, so I went with the Polish remnants of Polish army. We hide in a forest in Ukraine.
What was it like living in the forest?
First of all, it was very cold because, you know, that was the end of September, and Poland have a sometimes early start of winter in autumn. So we did have a blankets from the barn houses, and from the blankets we tried to make it little protection from the wind. And we did have a tobacco and vodka and all there. And so that's where some of the soldiers went to barter in the villages, Ukrainian, for vodka, for this, for little, for bread or warm, something warm to wear. Because we were not prepared to really stay in the winter in the forest.
Mm.
And that's where the one time it happened to me that I went with another nurse and two or three soldiers, and they left me on a watch because I did see the Russian trucks coming. I was scared. They with the bayonets affixed, I ran to the forest. And I was captured by three Russian soldiers. And I was brutally violated, beaten, and left in snow to die.
Hmm. One of the important messages that comes through in the book is, in addition to Irene, Jennifer, there were many other good people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true.
Talk with us about these folks. From the outset, Irene is very badly beaten. She's taken to a hospital, and she's recovering in a Russian hospital.
Right.
And
yes,
there are these good doctors.
Yep.
A Russian woman doctor.
Miriam.
Yep.
Yeah, she was very good.
And Dr. David.
Yes, that was from the village he was coming. Yeah, I just almost visualized him. I don't know to this day if he was Jewish or not. You know, but David, it sounded to me right now that as he was Jewish.
And these acts of kindness and the bravery that these people showed you, I would imagine, also put you on the path again
to help
others. Yeah.
Well, you know, you can be made from iron. When you walk street and you are caught and put in a place to watch the hanging, and I remember the hanging of the Polish couple, Catholic couple with two children, and Jewish couple with two children. They were hanging them in the middle of the marketplace. You know, this is something that you cannot forget. You close your eyes and you see. It's like in kaleidoscope, the picture moving before my eyes. And the older I get, before my heart. And I am struggling. I am not a well. I am not youngster. But I travel more than any other speaker through United States, Canada, London, Scotland. Every place they invite me, I go, and the kids love me. And I wanted them to understand that hate doesn't accomplish anything. And I asked God only for the other few years that my bishop, this is not my job. This is my mission in life. And the kids love me.
Yeah.
When I finish, even the big macho boys stay in line for hug and kisses. And I hug and kiss them. All one by one. Even the big macho boys.
Jennifer, why do you think young people really take Irene's story to heart?
Well, I've given that a lot of thought. And one reason, I think, is that they have seldom met anybody who's done something so extraordinary. The generation of kids today have grown up, very far removed from wars that affect them or their families. And so to meet somebody who's been in a position like this, it's almost like meeting somebody out of a movie or something. And one of the things that I hope, I don't know that it's true, but it probably is true in many cases, that kids, when they hear Irene's story, especially when they hear her speak in person, I hope kind of compare her accomplishments with the accomplishments of some of the celebrities whom a lot of kids are inclined to make heroes out of, and it's a pretty dramatic contrast between being, a best-selling entertainer or being a multimillionaire athlete, or risking your life for years at a time in order to save other people.
But you know, also, I find out that American children are hungry for love. They are hungry for love. And I think that many things is the divorces, and also many of the children, when I speak to children and I speak to parents, I always say, love your children. Have a time for them, the quality time. The kids are hungry. Because when I finish and I'm on the street going, they sometimes run after me, can I have another hug? Can I have another hug? And then many of them, they are so moved that they cry.
Well, Irene, it's not just because they are hungry for love. It's because they've never met somebody who did anything so extraordinary, and it touches them to their hearts. And I think that's what moves everybody who reads this story. Not teenagers or parents or people of that generation. And it's always very humbling to think about what Irene did and to always ask myself, could I do this? Mm-hmm. If I were put into this position, could I do this? And of course, nobody ever knows ahead of time whether they can do these things.
That's what I answer always when they say, I don't know. I say, depends what is the situation and how are you, in a way, raised too. You know, because many children maybe are not taught to love each other, you know, to help each other, you know. And I am just, the older I get, the more I am thankful that God used me and He's using me now. My time is short. I am not well. But I will not sit on a chair and cry about. When I am called, I go. I will go any place to the end of the earth for the young people, trying to tell them not to hate, to love each other, to help each other. We all belong to one human family.
Jennifer, one thing that I took away from the book that I think is very powerful is that Irene's efforts to help came a step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she put one foot in front of the other.
Right.
And did what she could, and she learned along the way.
Right. And that I think that's how many people end up doing extraordinary things. If you see the whole mountain in front of you, it's a little daunting. But, you know, if you just take the next, you know, few steps on the path, eventually you get there. And that, I think, is something that does make an impression on people, is that, of course, I could do that thing. That part seems easy, and then mm-hmm. and then you go on and you say, well, maybe I could do this next thing too.
Because necessity arrives, a necessity. There was a life in stake, you know. And I got used to those people that I took it care.
Right. I mean, and of course, I'm sure that if somebody had told Irene at the beginning of the war, Irene, what we want you to do is hide 12 Jews in the basement of a Nazi officer's house, I doubt that she would have said okay. But you know, you start with small things, and eventually,
at the time, yes.
Yeah, and then you end up. You find yourself in a position where this is the next step.
And there was no return, you know. You did have to go forward. You cannot stop with Howard being guilty of, like with the major, you know. I mean, he was an old man, but I could not think to just leave them and give them to be killed now, in this moment, in this time. So I did have to do the next thing. So, and I am very, very, the older I get, the more I am thankful to God for using me. Because when I did see that time killing the children, I threw a tantrum against God. I said, I don't believe in you. But you know, there was an answer in my soul, in my heart. And at this moment, I asked God, help me to help. I am giving my life to you. I am ready to give my life, but help me, help. And that's where the strength came. And the Lord put me in the right time at that right place. And I was blonde, blue-eyed, with the name Good. You see? So somehow, almost like I was predestined.
Mm-hmm. And you were only a girl.
I was only a girl, yes.
So they didn't They did not realize
when I told them where I have the hiding place. They could, oh, well, he may just realize Gestapo is coming, eating on top in a diner, and they were in a cellar.
Yeah, who would ever suspect such a pretty and innocent looking girl of flouting one of the most terrifying powers of the 20th century. But that's what she was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I didn't think that I was doing anything heroic. I thought that everybody that see the horrors, the killing, that they will reach and help. I didn't think I was an extraordinary. The situation that I did see every day happening, you know, it was just to steal from Hitler the lives.
You saw so much, Irene, and you had to hide your emotions. You had to hide your...
That's correct.
Your
I
contempt
did.
And your fear and... how did you manage that?
It was not easy, but you see, there was in a way, I knew that I have so many lives in my hands. And I did have to do it what needed to be done. They are not dolls, they are not toys, they are human beings.
How did you decide what risks to take and which risks not to take?
Well, you know, I did have many people ask me courage. Well, to me, what is a courage? Courage is a whisper from above. And when you listen with your heart, you not listen only with your head. Because the head tells you, oh, that danger, you know, put a big question mark, you know. So you have to listen with your heart and then connect with the brain how to do it, what is the situation, and how I can bring that to happen.
As I mentioned in the introduction, and as you've mentioned here as we've been talking, you hid 12 Jews in the home of an officer for whom you worked as a housekeeper.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about who they were and how
you
hid them.
This is really not spelled right. I probably, I did not tell Geneva. You see, there were 12 in the laundry room. Just before the liquidation of the laundry room, six of them were scared. They did not want to wait. And so Helen Weinbaum, that took a job on a farm, and we did have a horse and buggy, we brought those six to the forest. About 6 kilometers from town.
Can I break in and say this was the Jewish workers who were from the work camp, and they worked in the laundry facility at the ammunition factory where Irene was working for a while before she moved to the villa with the major.
Before she became a housekeeper,
right?
She worked in the dining room,
right? At a large
and
munitions
also,
factory.
Also, I brought it something to repair or wash or something to the laundry room. The mayor gave me another responsibility to take care of that. And, you know, so six of them, I took it to drop it off in a forest. So there were only six, and I thought that only six will come to the mayor's villa. But when I was finally camped, the villa was there, empty, you know, the people, the last couple moved out. And I went to the villa, there was a 12. because they have it. Friends have a friends or family. People were trying to save the lives. So the other six were in the forest, but new six came to the villa.
And this was at a time when you had learned that the SS was planning to wipe out.
That's correct.
The Jewish ghetto.
That's correct. And when I did see six of them, and they looked to me like to mother, and really, and only Funka Zilberman was more or less my age, but the rest were, there was a lawyer, there was a doctor, there was an accountant, you know, they were all there. There was a teacher. And I knew that the soldiers will come pretty soon to paint the villa. What'd I do? I figured out that they will not paint the attic, so I transported them to the attic. And then it was hard because they were painting downstairs, the servant quarters, the living room, dining room. And finally, when they finished downstairs, I took them from upstairs to the cellar, to the servants' quarters, put a big sign, Irene Gutovna, because that was the housekeeper of the major. You know, many miracles really happened in my life. I guess the Lord knew I am a young and not educated. I could not finish anything, you know. And somehow, I think it was predestined for me. Hmm.
There were so many close calls.
Yes. But what I say is predestined. I don't know if I told Jennifer that. But when I was born, and I was 1 year old, in a little place of Koznice, a little village, and my mother was very young. She was she was 18 when I was born, you know. And one day I run to the little brook that was full of water because I was born in May, so the ice melted, you know, and little dog that my mother did have pulled me by my tush and yelled and screamed because I wanted to get to the water. My mother did see me, ran and took me in her arm before I fell into the water. And in the little village, there was a very religious rabbi. And the rabbi gave me a blessing, and the priest gave me a blessing. And I knew about that the whole time because my mother, my grandmother told me, though. About 5 years ago when I was in Ohio speaking, and there was a very religious rabbi. And he invited me to speak to the ladies. And he asked me, so where were you born? And that trigger, the memory at that point. I said, Rabbi, my mother, grandmother told me that I was blessed by the rabbi when I was 1 year old. He said, you're not Jew. How come you're not Jewish? So I told him the story. And he was so moved. He said, Lubavitch, I find that what was the rabbi was Lubavitch, and he was a very old man and a good man, you know. And he was so moved that the dog saved little girl's life. And so he said, there is something great thing for the little one. And this rabbi in Ohio was Lubavitch too. And he wrote a finished book, and the title, Does the Woman Not Blush Anymore? And he signed it for me, his book, and signed it many, many blessings from the rabbis. Mm. And I receive blessing from the church, from the priest, and from the Jewish rabbis. Matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, I was in Loreto, Texas. Big group of people I spoke. There was a Catholic bishop and priest from Poland. There was around 700 people. So the priest, the bishop, said that prayer before I start speaking, and then the rabbi came out and say prayer. Seems like lately, when I speak, there is always the different groups from different religions. So I am so thankful for that.
Irene, what became of the people that you hid? Were you able to see them after the war?
Yes, yes, I have a picture with them in Krakow right after the war, before the Russian arrested me. I could not find it, my family, and the Russian, because I was in between getting from Ukraine, from Russia almost, Ukraine to Poland, and to Krakow. And there in Krakow, I met with some of the people whose life I saved. But I was in between in partisans because I could not go alone from the Russian side all the way to Krakow. So the Russian arrested me. And now the Jewish people that I was helping, they were helping me because the Russian put a death warrant on me, you know, because I escaped. And now I was spending little time with this one and that one and this one, and I could not be in Poland. I could not find my family. So now the Jewish people smuggled me out to Germany, to Jewish DP camp.
Mm-hmm.
I was one Catholic in Jewish DP camp. And that was 1949.
And that's how you got to America.
That's correct. You know, if I think about, you know, you start writing. Why I start writing the book with my daughter? Because my husband did have Alzheimer. And I was so scared that I will not remember.
Mm.
So, and the book, the story is the same, but Jennifer put it in beautiful way. She expressed that how I would like to express, but I am not a writer. You know, I can tell the story and this, but she has the ability to put that on a paper.
Well, it was a beautiful partnership.
Beautiful. Thanks. I am very grateful to her, and I love her very much.
Well, I love you too, Irene.
She's a wonderful, wonderful young lady, and I could not have anybody better to write my story.
To the two of you, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
It's
we love to do that.
Yeah,
Jennifer, I didn't see you for so long. And you know, I was just in New York, in New Jersey. In May, I was in Michigan. I stayed with the nuns there and speak in 900 people every day. Then I come 2 days home and I went to Loreto, Texas. And there was the Christian people and Jewish people. Then I come 2 days home and I went to New York and New Jersey. And the kids, the teenagers loved me so much. They did not have enough books.
Oh.
So So the teenagers, what they did, they come with the idea, please sign my shirt. I said, honey, I can, this is not a pen to sign a shirt's fabric. You will wash it, it will go away. He said, I will never wash it.
Well, thank you for having us on the show, Celeste.
My pleasure, Jennifer. It's an interview I'll never forget.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I love you.
Oh, I love you too, Irene.
And I hope I can see you once more.
Yes, me too.
Sometime in our traveling.
Yep.
And I am so glad that you know that book is translated in all languages.
Yep.
In Japanese and French and German and Scandinavian.
Take care of the two of you. I'm sorry we have to leave it there. Our guests this afternoon have been Irene Goodt-Opdyk and Jennifer Armstrong. Together they are the authors of In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer. Irene Opdyk comes from a Polish Catholic family. During the war, she became active in the resistance, aiding and rescuing Jews. Her involvement began when she was just 17 years old. And as we heard this afternoon, she is still involved, telling her story. In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer. Israel, the Israeli Holocaust Commission, and the Vatican have all honored Irene Opdyk for her actions during the war. In My Hands is available in a paperback edition from Anchor Books.